Law counsel is coming up. I'd like to say welcome to our guests from Bulgaria. We've got a group of lawyers and judges that Judge Miller and I spoke with this morning. It's a delight to have all of you with us today.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Natalie Decker and I represent Scott Depper, who is present in court with me today. The United States Supreme Court has acknowledged that society wins not only when guilty or convicted, but when criminal trials are fair. Scott Depper did not get a fair trial in this case. But the question really is, what can this court do about that? This court can and should reverse the conviction in this case. This court should remand this case for a new trial, for a fair trial. I understand that we have quite a lengthy record here, so I'd like to focus on really two primary issues today. The first issue is the fact that it was error to even admit evidence of the accuser's alleged lack of sexual experience in the first place. This evidence was evidence that the prosecution injected into this case. They sought to admit this evidence, and that issue was litigated before we ever even went to trial in this case. And I'm sorry, if I could also note, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You'll get the yellow light at 5 minutes, but actually monitoring the time is up to you.
Excellent, thank you. So this was an issue that was litigated prior to the trial. And the prosecution advised the court that they had to have this evidence. They acknowledged that in a case like this, which is essentially, it's essentially a he said, she said type of case, they told the court that this evidence was critical, and they outlined a number of reasons for why they had to admit this particular evidence. They said it would explain her naivete, her lack of understanding about sexual advances, her ability to describe what was happening, why she was unable to say with confidence whether or not the defendant's penis was erect, why it took so long to recognize what it was happening, the delay in reporting, it would explain, it would rationalize, and so on. The fact is, this evidence should not have been admitted in the first place. It was not relevant, but even if you assume that it was relevant, this evidence was overly prejudicial. This evidence was used to inflame the jury. It was used to appeal to their emotion. In fact, at one point in the closing argument, the prosecution said, in order to believe the defendant, you would have to believe that this girl with no sexual experience came on to her pastor. That, by the way, that's not what they told the court that they were going to admit this evidence for. And this is unlike the Fletcher case, which both parties have cited to. The Fletcher case found that admission of evidence about a victim's lack of sexual experience, that was error in that particular case, but it was harmless. And the court noted in that case that the evidence was overwhelming in that case, and the primary issue was intoxication of the victim.
Well, the evidence, if I can interrupt you here in a second.
Sure.
The evidence in that case was also that it was too broad.
Right.
The virginity for, you know, her entire life, that it would not necessarily explain the vaginal tear caused by the defendant there because it could have healed.
Correct.
The kind of implicit assumption there was that evidence like this history can come in certain circumstances. And so, I mean, I hear what you're saying. My concern on the evidence piece is that there's a discretionary call here.
Right.
The court weighed everything and said there's some relevance here. And as you know, on a 403 assessment on appeal, we have to assume the maximum probative value and the minimal prejudice.
Right.
It's a pretty hard burden.
And I understand that, and unfortunately that's where I'm at. And I do understand that, and I'm not suggesting that that evidence is not ever admissible, but it should not be admitted without extreme caution. And the error in admitting the evidence in this case is the fact that it turns out not to be true.
Well, that's a different issue, though, right?
This
is the issue that I'm probably most concerned about, and your colleague across the table is going to hear it from me as well.
Sure.
I have some concern when the prosecutor made a big, big deal about this evidence, and then it turns out, arguably, or maybe not even arguably, not true. I think the problem on your side is the standard for your trial. I mean, the court did ultimately, although the court first said it's untimely, the court then was willing to listen to the evidence and rule on the merits on the second new trial motion.
Right.
And said, this is merely impeaching, wouldn't change the result, you've got the pretext call, Mr. Duffer essentially confessed. How do you get past the standard on a new trial on that?
Well, I think it's impossible for this court to conclude that the admission of the evidence that turns out to be false, and by the way, it's not one thing, there are several things. Not only is there the issue of the alleged lack of sexual experience, which is blatantly not true. That is an issue that they injected, and it's clearly not true, and by the way, it's unrefuted in the record. They've never refuted the facts. Or disputed the factual veracity of the newly discovered evidence. But there are actually several things. The one quote that I'd like to direct the court's attention to out of the Whip case specifically says, because that was in a case where they looked at an issue of false evidence. And the court said, if this evidence was not important and material, why was it offered and why was it received? Coming from the lips of a woman supposed to be telling the truth, this evidence would naturally have weight with the jury and must be presumed to have influenced the jury in arriving at its verdict. There's simply no way to conclude that the admission of this evidence and the newly discovered evidence would not affect the outcome. And I'm going to disagree with the, respectfully, of course, with the court's conclusion about the pretext phone call. Pretext phone calls are supposed to be the smoking gun in a case like this. The fact is, my client never confessed. What he said was, it was a sin. And for somebody who is a person of faith, we can all understand saying that you've sinned about something. Well, probably most of us have sinned an awful lot of times throughout every single day. A sin can be something as minor as an impure thought. It can be not trusting God in the outcome of something. It can mean any number of things. He did not admit. There's no admission. There's no physical evidence. There's no witness. We're left with a he said, she said, where there's overwhelming evidence in the record that this young lady falsified information, and not just once. That information is in the opening. It's in the testimony. It's in the pretext phone call. It's in the phone call that was between the detective and my client, which turns out the day that I turned in my brief, I learned had been turned in twice to the jury. They admitted it once in a redacted form, which we had agreed upon, and then they also admitted it in unredacted form on another exhibit.
Doesn't all of this, though, go to the victim's credibility?
I'm not going to dispute that it goes to the credibility, and it certainly is impeaching evidence. But I don't. This goes far beyond simply impeaching evidence.
Okay, tell me exactly how your argument goes beyond showing that the victim's statements about her naivety were untrue.
It goes to what the evidence would show, what was happening that week, what were the circumstances surrounding the incident. It corroborates what my client says.
What did your client say that this corroborates, that the investigator's affidavit corroborates?
My client indicated that they were on the couch, that she started touching his, rubbing his feet, rub his leg, or
okay,
excuse me.
How does the investigator's affidavit corroborate that? She had a boyfriend, so how does the investigator's corroborate? Affidavit corroborate what you just said.
Because it corroborates what my client says, because it shows that very week she's sneaking around having a physical relationship with other people. That to me, it is not the same as, well, you said this over here, but you said something different over here. That to me is what would be, quote, merely impeaching evidence. This goes far beyond that. We also have evidence about, I heard for the first time in trial, that it was a play that they were working on, that her group was working on. Turns out this play is the vagina monologues. They were working on a play at that time. So you mean to tell me, you can't describe an alleged butt touch over the clothes, that you can produce a play where you talk about things like what your vagina would dress up as? I mean, this is unbelievable.
Counsel, it came out of trial, right?
It did not. It did not. I did not know about that until after the trial. What came out at trial was that we heard for the first time, she had been working on a play. After the trial, when we started learning about this new information, and by the way, if I could sidetrack for one moment, because I'm almost out of time, I do want to make it clear that the way that we got to the new evidence, particularly on the relationship issue, it was that post-trial motion. The fact is, the district, or excuse me, post-trial report from the district attorney's office. The fact is, on May 7th, they got some new information. May 8th, they sent an investigator out to talk with this young lady. They got that information. They prepared a report. It was not until May 23rd, which is what, almost 2 weeks after I filed my motion, that I even received notice of this information. In this report, it contained names of people who had never been referenced. So I can tell you, I didn't interview those people. I didn't know they had any information even remotely relevant. My investigator went and interviewed people. As a result of those interviews, he was led to other people.
Counsel, where is that in the record?
What's that? That is in my motion for a new trial.
Well, it's in your motion, perhaps, but that's not verified, is it? Mr. Schubert's affidavit gives no explanation of why he didn't do this interview until June 12th. Or June 10th, whatever the odds.
And I believe that what his affidavit said, it doesn't go into detail. I think what his affidavit says, it explains that these people were afraid, they were reluctant. I explained in my motion, and my position is, and I have not found any Colorado case law to the contrary, that not every single fact in a motion for a new trial has to be contained in an affidavit. It's not in the rule. The rule does say that it has to be supported, but it doesn't say that every single fact has to be in an affidavit. And the fact is, we should have gotten a hearing. We were not even given an opportunity to present any in-person under oath testimony, which we would have been happy to do. And I see that I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to reserve the last 3 minutes.
One quick question. Did you ask for an evidentiary hearing before the lower court?
I did, Your Honor. I asked repeatedly for a hearing.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people.
Before you start your argument, I should have cautioned your opponent as well. These arguments are available on the internet, so please refer to the parties by their status, like victim or initials, to the extent they're minors.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, in this case, the judgment of conviction should be affirmed because the defendant received a fair but not perfect trial. And that is what justice requires. Now, I'll move directly to the evidence of the victim's lack of sexual experience and why that was properly admitted in this case. The prosecution filed a motion in limine to admit the evidence, and the trial court determined that it was appropriate to admit the evidence because it went to the victim's delay in reporting, something that People v. Fassie tells us is an important aspect of a sexual assault on a child case, and sexual assaults in general, because delayed reporting is something that juries often have trouble understanding. But it also went to the victim's inability to perceive the events as they occurred on the day in question. So her lack of sexual experience was relevant and admissible under 402, and not overly prejudicial under 403, particularly because it did not go to the actual elements of the case, but instead provided context for the jury to understand the victim's report, as well as her delay in reporting.
Ms. Grundy, I'll jump right in. I promised I was going to ask. I'm concerned on the new trial piece of this, and I'd like you to address it. To me, the prosecution did harp on this evidence, and you know, forget about whether it went to sympathy or whatever else. Put that aside. The prosecution made a big point of saying this woman was naive, that's why she didn't report, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out, you know, she had never even held hands with a boy. Now it turns out, well, she did hold hands with a boy, and she kissed a boy before this happened. That causes me some real concern. The whole flavor of the case changes on that. And I'm very interested to hear, why does Mr. Duffer get a new trial with her? Doesn't that change the whole complexion of the case? Take all of that out, what the prosecution can't make any of those points. May change a lot of this case and at least call it a question, arguably call it a question of verdict. So push back, but I'm just telling you, that concerns me a lot in this case.
I understand your concerns, Your Honor, but there are two reasons why it does not justify a new trial in this case. The first is that the motion, in order to justify granting a motion for a new trial, it must be affirmatively probative of the defendant's innocence, and it must show essentially that either a crime did not occur, that the defendant did not commit this crime. Neither of those are present by the fact that the victim may have had previous, I would call them romantic, relationships with the person. It also still doesn't establish her lack of sexual experience. There has been no allegation that the victim actually had a sexual relationship with this young man. And even if she did, it does not go to probative of the defendant's innocence. Now, it would be impeaching information at best. And what Farrer tells us is that even in situations where there may be an allegation that evidence that there was some sort of false or mistaken testimony, even if it could potentially be perjury, it does not justify a new trial unless it actually goes to showing that it would be probative of the defendant's innocence. That's simply not even remotely present here. At best, it casts doubt on the victim's credibility, something that the defense thoroughly cross-examined at trial, not only through its examination of the victim, but also through the examination of the victim's entire family.
So what evidence, this is a question going, what's the line, what evidence would establish that we go to probative of innocence? Do you need an actual eyewitness? Is that the only evidence that would allow a new trial, or what? What's the line?
Your Honor, one thing maybe if it was actually showing that the victim had been at a different location on the day in question. If there had been other persons present, they would have witnessed it. If there had been some type of evidence that was actually relevant to the facts of the case, something showing that the defendant was out of the country, something showing that the victim was unconscious in the hospital, something along these lines that actually goes to the facts of the case and the charges before the jury. That's not what we have here.
Well, let me ask you, I'm sorry, finish your sentence, excuse me.
Please go ahead, Your Honor.
This is a hypothetical. Take a case where it turns out, evidence comes out after the fact that the complaining person is a pathological liar and has no ability to tell the truth on anything whatsoever. Is that merely impeaching, or does that go to innocence?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question. Now, it could potentially be impeaching information depending on what the witness testified to. If it's the complaining witness, we'd likely have more serious concerns. But if it's someone who testifies that I saw the victim on this day and she was wearing a purple sweater, then whether she's wearing a purple sweater is certainly not material to the case. If it's the complaining witness, it may be a different situation. But again, if in order to determine whether a new trial is justified, we'd look at the totality of the evidence in that trial and the evidence of corroboration. If there's further evidence of corroboration, even a pathological liar's testimony may not justify a new trial. And certainly, Farrer tells us, even in the instance of perjury, even in the instance of testimony that may be false or mistaken, in that case, a recanting witness who actually recants all of the allegations in the case did not justify granting a new trial. And the victim's potential relationship with this young man in no way does that.
Is there any corroboration here other than the so-called pretext clause?
Your Honor, the corroboration would be the victim's testimony. We also have testimony.
Well, that's not corroboration. I mean, that's her testimony. So we got her testimony, a portion of which seems to have been perjurious. What is the independent corroborating evidence?
Well, there would be the defendant's statement in which he admits that he has an erection during the course of this event. That should go directly to sexual gratification. It also goes to the victim's presence on the couch.
That's the pretext call.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any other corroboration?
Yes. The defendant's interview with Detective Tanguma, in which he admits that he had an erection at the time. That directly goes to, this did occur. Exactly how it occurred is still a factual question for the jury. We also have corroborating events of the timeline. We have the victim's sister, her older sister, who testifies that they were present in the house on that day. We have the victim's mother who testifies that they did in fact go to the Renaissance Festival, and she observed the victim sitting in the defendant's lap in a manner that was inappropriate on the day that this assault occurred. So we do have corroborating evidence of the timeline, providing the specific fact that the victim was in the defendant's house. We have the defendant admitting that the victim was on his couch and that he had an erection with her. So the totality of the circumstances here does not depend on whether the victim in fact had held a boy's hand. If we look at this, it does not go to probative of the defendant's innocence and instead goes to impeachment on a collateral matter, which is exactly what the trial court found in its ruling on the motion for a new trial. It would impeach only a small portion of the victim's testimony. And at trial, there was also substantial information elicited about the circumstances in the victim's home. In particular, that she would have had to hide a relationship had she had one. Defense counsel thoroughly cross-examined this issue in discussing the victim's older sister and how she'd had a secret relationship she'd hidden from her father because he was going to withhold college tuition and essentially make her choose between the boy or the family. So the circumstances of relationships in this family came out. There was a substantial questioning of credibility, and the defense testimony relied in large part on the fact that the witness did not appear credible. In fact, defense closing argument said, truth doesn't change, in focusing specifically on the victim. So it's merely a question of credibility, something that was before the jury and that they decided. This is not probative of the defendant's innocence. It does not establish that he could not have committed the crime. It does not establish that no crime was committed. And it certainly does not establish that someone else could have committed the crime. And evidence of lack of sexual experience is what was admitted, not evidence of lack of romantic experience, which is the only even suggestion we have with this boy.
But she did say, and this is just to make sure I have the facts right, I had never even held another boy's hand before.
Yes, Your Honor, that was unelicited. That was not actually the question that was posed to her, but it certainly did come in.
I just wanted to make sure I had the facts. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. But the information was admitted to show that the victim would have difficulty perceiving whether the defendant, in fact, had an erection on the couch. Whether she had held a boy's hand does not establish that she would not have had difficulty perceiving whether the defendant had an erection. And to the other claims in the defendant's motion for a new trial, specifically with the reference to the purity retreats or the victim's alleged participation in the vagina monologues, this is in no way exculpatory evidence. It's not material. I don't even actually see how it would be impeaching evidence because the victim never testified as to any of this. She had trouble discussing sexual terms at trial. The fact that she may have participated in the vagina monologues does not impeach this testimony. It's an entirely different context. For all we know, she was a set designer in the vagina monologue. She may have had nothing to do with actual participation in the case. And it doesn't cast doubt on the credibility. It doesn't actually impeach anything she said. And it's in fact quite consistent with her being a victim of sexual assault if you look to the actual purposes of the vagina monologues.
This play was after the alleged assault, right?
We have no idea, Your Honor.
Okay.
The defense motion does not establish those facts. Now, with respect to the discovery issues in this case, the defense has alleged that the defendant has been denied a fair trial. That's simply not the case. And we would know that the defendant had the ability to address this had he raised any of the discovery issues before trial, particularly with respect to the defense investigator. Had he raised that issue before trial, the court could have granted a continuance. The court could have addressed the issue. The court could have granted a remedy. The same is true with the information that came in that the defense now complains was not disclosed. Had the defense objected at the time it was admitted at trial, there would be a record for this court to review. The trial court could have granted a continuance. None was ever even requested. This is not a case where the defendant was denied a fair trial. The trial may not have been perfect, but it certainly was fair.
Can you just talk about briefly this issue about the investigator, which I think was part of the new trial motion, alleged some coercive tactics by the DA's office on the investigator. I suppose maybe your argument here is there was no affidavit of that, so it didn't even get considered. So that's question number one, is that right?
Yes,
assuming you don't need an affidavit, why wouldn't you get a new trial? What else do you need to say? There's coercion here by the DA. Why don't you get a hearing on that?
Your Honor, first and foremost, there would be required to be an affidavit. This is certainly newly discovered evidence, if it's anything. So it would require an affidavit to even get an evidentiary hearing. Now, in order to justify a new trial, we would have to know something about what this man would have testified to. We don't even have that. There was never an offer of proof presented to the trial court. And this was certainly known prior to trial that this man would be unable to testify. Yet the defense never raised it. They never gave the trial court an opportunity to address the issue and never even moved for a continuance, which in motions for a new trial completely discredits any claim of prejudice, and particularly when discovery violations come up. When a discovery violation is alleged, the defendants need to do something, to request a continuance at the time the information becomes known, to object at trial. If no such remedies are requested, it defeats the claim of prejudice, and that's precisely what we're looking at here. The defense did not object to many of the statements they now claim on appeal, and the motion for a new trial does not preserve trial error. It does allow this court to consider the denial of the motion for a new trial, but it does not change the standard of review. In this case, the defendant received precisely what he was entitled to, a fair but not perfect trial. And if this court has no further questions, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of conviction.
Well, unfortunately, I've only left myself 3 minutes, and I'm not going to be able to respond to everything. So a couple of things that I did want to respond to quickly. First of all, I'm going to completely disagree with the status of the evidence with regard to whether my client said he had an erection. That is simply not in the evidence. Where that issue comes up is a conversation that my client had with the investigator, which, by the way, the investigator failed to report. He had several issues in this case with failing to preserve evidence. And when I pressed him on cross-examination about that very issue, he couldn't remember. And if you had an opportunity to read through the record, Detective Tanguma had an awful lot of difficulty remembering much of anything in connection with this case. In fact, he testified at one point that the victim told him something that actually she did not tell him. So that is simply not the case.
Susan, I just want to clarify. You're saying that the investigator's interview on the telephone did not go into evidence?
No, actually, I'm not saying that. Oh, okay. That did go into evidence. The first phone call that he made, he said he made a mistake and he didn't record that. So then he called back several hours later and then he gave a brief narrative. My client says, okay, yes, that's about the extent of what my client says. So my client is not on the record anywhere, certainly not in the pretext phone call, which, by the way, in the pretext phone call, even though the victim was asked to ask him specific questions about why did you touch me here, why did you do this, why did you do that, she never did that. She didn't do that because she knew she wasn't going to like the answers that she would get, because he would say, what are you talking about? I didn't do that. But the other thing that I want to talk about, I really haven't even touched on this at all for the last minute. Rule 33 does not require an affidavit to be submitted on everything. There are actually two different prongs. I didn't write Rule 33. What Rule 33 says is that you can either ask for a new trial in the interest of justice, or you can ask for a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence. Newly discovered evidence does have to be supported by affidavits. However, these are not mutually exclusive. The court can and should consider everything. I would submit to you, to the court, that you should consider all of the newly discovered evidence in addition to all of the other issues that were raised in this case and make the determination that a new trial is in the interest of justice. The court can and should do that. This is not a situation, we've all had cases where you don't like the outcome, or where you lose something that you thought you should have won. This is not that case. What happened in this case is wrong. This goes contrary to the principles of liberty and justice. This goes contrary to the whole purpose behind the criminal justice system. To have relied on perjured testimony and a host of other issues to get a conviction, that's outrageous and it is unacceptable. And I would also
your
like to
time is exhausted, counsel.
May I have a moment to conclude?
Yes.
Thank you. I would also, in asking the court to reverse this conviction and remand the case for a new trial, ask the court to keep in mind that attorneys make strategy decisions and give their clients advice based on the information that they had. I did not have a whole host of information to have properly advised my client in this case. And consequently, I'm asking you to amend this case for a new trial. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.